Is the United States a Christian nation? Well, I guess that depends on whom you ask, but in one sense, for most of our history, it's been indisputable that the vast majority of Americans self-identify not just as Christians, but as Protestants. But all of that is changing. Indeed, in 2012, in a Pew Research poll, a rising group of people, up to 20%, have identified themselves as none of the above. There's been a lot of discussion about this, but its social, its religious implications. Today, we're going to talk about its constitutional implications with two ministers, one of whom is also a constitutional scholar and a college student as well. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and our subject today is the rise of the nuns.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Our subject today is the rise of the nuns. That's N-O-N-E-S. People who, in a 2012 Pew Research poll, didn't identify themselves as Protestants or Catholics or Jews, but rather as none of the above. Now, these people were not all atheists or even agnostics. Some of them said, insisted that they were very spiritual, but they simply did not adhere to any of the recognized religious groups. Now, this really caught my attention, as it did the attention of many people, certainly from a societal viewpoint, from a religious viewpoint. It's a fascinating statistic from a number of angles. But of course, our focus on this show is the Constitution. And as you know, the Constitution has a lot to say about religion. We've got two clauses specifically devoted to it in the First Amendment. We call them the religion clauses. And over our constitutional history, those clauses have been interpreted by a society that was overwhelmingly Protestant, and even by a Supreme Court that was overwhelmingly Protestant. But guess what? That society is changing. And indeed, the court itself is changing. Have you noticed that we don't have a Protestant majority on the Supreme Court anymore? We don't have any Protestants on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is made up of 5 Catholics and 4 Jews. Now, there's been a lot of commentary about that, but is that going to change the way the court interprets the religion clauses? And more broadly, is our changing society going to have any impact on that? Well, I don't know if we can answer all those questions today, but we're sure going to take a crack at it. We're going to take a crack at it with three different people, three people that I think have each has something to say. The first is familiar to WETS listeners. He's John Shuck. He is a local Presbyterian minister in Elizabethton, Tennessee. He also has a program here, an excellent program called Religion for Life. We're also going to hear from Garrett Sheldon, who is a Southern Baptist minister and a member of the Political Science Department at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. And finally, we're going to hear from a University of Virginia student. His name is Ben Harris, and yep, he's my kid. Let's start with John Shuck. Welcome to your weekly Constitutional.
Stuart, it's good to be here.
Well, who are you and what do you do?
Well, a couple of hats. One is that I'm a minister at the Presbyterian Church in Elizabethton. I've been a minister for about 20 years.
Wow.
And this is my third congregation. Been here about 8.5. And then I host, as you know, a radio program on WETS, Religion for Life.
A great show that I really enjoy listening to. And you're right. That's exactly how you and I met. I believe I remember the day we met. You were here at the station, and you were on deadline, and you were harried, but you were still nice enough to stop and smile and introduce yourself before you went back to your duties.
Oh, well, I'm glad you remembered me that way.
Absolutely, I did. And we've run our paths across on a number of occasions since that time. And in fact, most recently, you were kind enough to come over to Emory and Henry to the First Amendment seminar that I've been teaching. And you and Garrett Sheldon from up at UVA Wise had a very interesting discussion about a number of religious and political issues.
Yeah, we're talking about the class was on the First Amendment.
Yeah.
And talking about it from a religious perspective.
Right.
So that was great. I really enjoyed that. Really enjoyed the students and everyone.
That was a great evening. It was very interesting because, of course, Garrett, I'm sure, would not mind me saying that he tends to be of a more conservative religious perspective. He is a pastor at a a Baptist church up in Big Stone Gap, and you obviously come from a different tradition, but both of you are pastors, and I think it's very important for us to remember that the Constitution wasn't written for lawyers. Lawyers tend to monopolize the conversation about it, and most of the discussion in my First Amendment seminar had been from a lawyer's perspective. I mean, that's my background. But it, you know, religious people who are not necessarily lawyers obviously care very passionately about these things. And so that was a really, really interesting discussion that evening.
Yeah, it sure was.
And the students just ate it up. And I was very proud of them. I thought they asked some good questions.
Were some stumpers, too.
They didn't pull any punches, did they?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they really didn't. Well, anyway, that was our most recent crossing of paths. And I think it was at that point that I asked if you'd be willing to come in and talk to us today about this this interesting new phenomenon. I call it the rise of the nuns. That's N-O-N-E-S. Mm-hmm. And I don't want people thinking there's just some great rebellion of all these.
You might be thinking of nuns on the bus.
Nuns, no, nothing like that. It's N-O-N-E-S, people who say that they are none of the above. They don't practice any particular religion or belong to any particular religious sect, but they consider themselves perhaps spiritual. So I understand you have some experience with this or some perspective to offer on this subject.
Well, I first heard about the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, when I did an interview with the Gary Lauderman, who is a religion professor at Emory University.
Right.
And he wrote an article on the Huffington Post about the rise of the nuns. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that that's the largest growing, I guess that's the group that is growing the fastest when you check out those surveys. And that's really within the last few years of those who are selecting no religion in terms of that category. And that number seems to be growing. Cool. And now, from his perspective, he doesn't necessarily mean that those who are none are necessarily atheists. Some might be. But he's saying that the idea of religious affiliation is of less interest to more people.
Well, what is the significance of that? Or why is it happening?
Well, there are good reasons for that, I think. I mean, we're kind of speculating, and I guess my I don't certainly have any quantitative data as to why.
Okay, but from your perspective as a pastor, from your perspective as someone who obviously is very interested in religion in the United States, what might you think that this is attributable to?
I think there are probably two reasons. I'll say them, and then I'll explain them a little bit. One, I think, has to do with perceived bad behavior of religious institutions.
No.
And the second is that the theology of religious institutions is no longer credible. Huh. And it often goes from one to the other. I give an example of this. I was at a meeting in Cleveland of a group called the Covenant Network of Presbyterians. And this is kind of a subgroup of my denomination, the Presbyterian Church USA, working for more inclusion for gay and lesbian people in the life of the denomination. So they're having their annual meeting. And one of the speakers was a sociologist, a young woman, I would guess probably 30. And she was talking about different issues regarding sexuality. And then the question came to her about her religion, and she says, "Well, I'm not really involved anymore. I used to be a Methodist, and I was upset kind of about the policies and kind of working against them. And then as it got along, I realized that the whole thing just wasn't credible."
Hmm.
And so for her, it was kind of the ethical, the entrenchment of the views that didn't appeal to her. And then as she kind of got into it, she realized, you know, this whole system doesn't seem to be of interest to me
anymore. So it's just people questioning the doctrines.
I think so. I think a lot of it is the questioning of the doctrine itself, questioning it in light of part of my own story with, mm-hmm, with sure. others is the story of the rise of modern science, evolution. When I grew up in church, it was a different denomination, and the preacher would call it evolution. Okay, so, I don't think you can get away with that anymore and actually be credible. And so that's one of the feather, or the very fact of doctrine
making
sense.
But before we go on with that, though, I'll play devil's advocate, or perhaps I should say I'll play God's advocate
there
in this case. there are many people, many religious people, who believe that evolution is quite consistent with their religious beliefs. In fact, I believe the Catholic Church has said that they believe in something that's commonly called theistic evolution, that God did create all of the universe, but when it came to life, he's the one who decided that evolution would be the mechanism, so he started it up, and that's how he created Adam and Eve. It took him a little longer than 7 days, but that's okay. Yeah. So, I mean, not every religious doctrine is something that rejects evolution, or that, you know, that a thinking person who understands evolution wouldn't necessarily himself or herself have to reject.
Yeah, sure. And Michael Zimmerman, professor of biology at Butler University, started the Darwin Day celebrations for churches, Evolution mm-hmm. Sunday. And his idea was to get that group, 10,000 clergy, he got to sign saying that evolution is not incompatible with their faith.
Okay.
And so certainly, and many more mainstream churches have gone there.
Okay.
I'm mostly thinking of probably the more conservative churches who really do believe that evolution is against the Bible, that it's one or the other.
So you think that people in those denominations, where the denomination has decided that evolution is incompatible, are the ones who are then abandoning those doctrines? Because
I think in some cases they often don't feel that there is another option. They haven't heard of these odd liberal groups that suddenly have found a way to embrace science.
That's kind of interesting. You could actually sort of put a Darwinian argument in this one. Those religions that failed to adapt to modern science may be on their way to extinction.
I think that's really part of it. Mm-hmm. So the doctrines of and when I say evolution, we can even put it in a larger sense of not just biological evolution, but the very looking at what cosmologists are talking about, the universe itself. And so philosophically, for many people, the faith they grew up in isn't quite big enough to handle what they are learning from the secular world or modern science, and finding that to be a credibility issue.
Mm-hmm. That certainly is prevalent in the much more visible atheist movement these days. When I was growing up, and I think you and I are about the same age, we're both getting old here now, we're both in our early 50s. When I was growing up, I think lots of atheists were out there, but they were like closeted gay people. They kind of kept things to themselves, because to be an atheist was to be even lower on the public esteem spectrum than car salesmen and lawyers, for heaven's sake. But lately, the last 10 or 15 years, there's just been a slew of books by prominent atheists, and I think that there's been lots more opening up going on out there. Is that also part of it?
I think so. I had on my program Daniel Dennett, one of the new atheists. He, along with Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris, mm-hmm. all wrote books about the middle of the 2000s, 2005, 2007. And he talked to me on the program about, he said, well, there used to be, the very thing you said, we've always been atheists, and we've just kind of kept to ourselves. And then we realize, actually, it's important for us to be able to say what we really think and what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that awareness is also contributing to kind of a rise in secularism or a rise in the nuns.
Yeah, that might be very much a part of it. In fact, my son Ben is also going to be on the show today, and he and I talked about his experience at the University of Virginia with younger people. And I think he mentioned in that interview, if not, he certainly has mentioned to me elsewhere, that there is actually like an atheist student union or something mm-hmm. similar. And at a traditional place like the University of Virginia, where there is such a strong religious tradition and where there are still very many religious students and religious student groups, the idea that there would be this open expression of atheism really kind of struck me. I don't think 30 years ago you would have found many colleges with an atheist student union in them.
Yeah, well, even ETSU, atheist or skeptics or free thinking, it depends on how what the name is
right.
lately, but that organization, and they've had some struggles. I remember talking to students who would say that the two groups that would have their posters taken down at ETSU would be the gay rights group
right.
and the atheist group.
Oh boy.
Those two groups together would have the social stigma
right.
of being who they were.
I wonder if that's still the case now.
You know, I it could be. And this is just a few years ago. So, my
possibly.
Hunch is that more and more are coming out,
right.
both as gay and both as atheist. Not necessarily the same people, mm-hmm. but those same movements. And that leads kind of to the second, the reason we talk about, I mentioned that some of it's belief, and the other, I think, is also to do with behavioral issues. And David Kinnaman, who's an evangelical of the Barna Group, mm-hmm. was talking about why young people are leaving the church. And he said one of the main issues is because the perception of LGBT issues. Mm-hmm. The church has been anti for the most part. And young people are not there. And so they see that as restrictive and as not interesting.
Yeah, it'd be very tough to be a member of many religious denominations and to be gay or bisexual or transgendered or any of those things, and to be told on a daily basis that you're evil and mm-hmm. what you're doing is wrong. So I can see that being a very alienating factor as well. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with John Shuck, who is a Presbyterian minister and the host of the public radio show Religion for Life, produced at WETS. After the break, we'll speak some more to John Shuck, but first, of course, we'll have our Constitutional quiz, so stick around.
Once again, it's time for the Constitutional Quiz, and here, too close for comfort, is the quiz guy.
Hey, Stuart, how are you? Good to see you.
Good. Good to see you as well. We're right here next to the same microphone today. I don't know. It's getting kind of cozy here in the studio.
I wish I had my breath mints.
I do, too. I wish you had yours. So tell me, do you have a hard quiz question for us today?
I have a great quiz question.
Well, tell us. What is it?
All right, here we go. It's an often laborious task to change the Constitution, right? I mean, we know despite over 10,000 attempts, it's only happened 27 times. I want to know, what amendment was the fastest to have ratified?
The quickest ratification.
Mm-hmm, the quickest ratification. Which
oh,
one was
man.
The fastest? Was it A, the Second Amendment to keep and bear arms? Was it B, the 15th Amendment opening voting to all races and colors and regardless of previous servitude? Was it C, the 19th Amendment, opening suffrage up to all genders? Or was it the 26th Amendment, opening voting to anyone 18 years or older? What was the quickest, the fastest?
Quiz guy, I must admit, I have never, ever thought about this question. I'm wondering if our contestant has. Do we have a contestant online?
We do.
Tremendous.
My name's Jennifer Polk.
Where are you from, Jennifer?
Pipestem, West Virginia.
Pipestem, West Virginia. Pipestem. What is Pipestem?
It's probably the most wonderful town.
Is it really?
In all of the nation. Yeah, I think so.
Tremendous. Where does that name come from?
Honestly, I'm not sure. We have a creek running through there called Pipestem Creek.
Okay, it's named after the creek, and it's a wonderful place. Well, did you hear the question?
I did.
Tremendous. Do you have any idea what the answer might be?
I have a guess. Can I hear the answers again?
Sure. Quiz guy, go ahead.
Sure. What amendment was the quickest or the fastest to ratify? Was it the Second Amendment, the 15th Amendment to open voting to all races and colors, the 19th Amendment opening to all genders, or the 26th Amendment opening voting to anyone 18 years and older?
I am going to go with A, the Second Amendment.
The Second Amendment to keep and bear arms. Why are you going with that choice?
We like our guns, so it seems like it'd be quickest.
So you think people back then liked their guns so much that it was just a really quick amendment?
I think so.
Yeah, barely a second thought, I bet.
Barely a second. Oh, good one, Doug. Okay. Well, how did she do, Doug?
Not so well. Hey, Jennifer, first of all, love that accent. I got to tell you, it is actually the 26th Amendment. It took only 107 days. This thing to leave the Congress and get through the states required, the three-quarter states required in 1971 to change the voting age from 21 to 18.
That is astonishing.
Wow.
107 days?
Yeah, I mean, think about it. There's this government currently, it takes them 107 days to decide whether they're going to come to work or not. But at the time, of course, there was a lot of pressure from the Vietnam War, and you saw more and more young people getting involved both politically and with activism in the streets. And some of the states were probably getting a little nervous in 1971. And so here we are coming off of the heels of that war in Vietnam. Sure enough, they changed the Constitution, and now everyone 18 years or older can vote.
Well, that is a remarkable tale. And Jennifer, don't feel bad, because I had no idea myself. That was a really tough question.
Well, if you didn't know, then I don't feel so bad.
Well, don't feel bad. And in fact, we have a really wonderful consolation prize for you. Doug is personally going to send you a James Madison Montpelier version of the Constitution.
I can do that. I would love to do that, Jennifer.
That sounds great.
All right. Well, thanks for playing, Jennifer.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. Our subject today is the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, those people who claim to have no religious affiliation, not Protestant, not Jewish, not Catholic, but they might be spiritual nonetheless. We're talking with John Shuck, the pastor of the Presbyterian First Presbyterian Church of Elizabethton, Tennessee, and the host of the public radio show Religion for Life. What about this group of people that call themselves spiritual but not religious? How do they fit into this whole equation?
You know, I just did a presentation at Tusculum College just this last week, and to an honors class, and we're talking about kind of the issues of religion and philosophy. I was invited to speak there, and I went around and asked the students to define religion. Because in part of the introduction, and almost all of them defined it negatively.
Oh, really?
They defined it as, institutional rules, or mostly that, politics.
Tusculum College in Northeast Tennessee.
Yes, that's.
And the students are defining religion negatively.
They defined it, but they had a positive word for spirituality.
Oh, okay.
They said, I'm spiritual. I don't like the religion part. And that's the whole institution. You know, when I named my program Religion for Life, I knew that was going to come. I could have called it Spirituality for Life or Faith for Life, but that isn't where I wanted to go. I knew religion was the meat of it. We had to get down and dirty and
right.
Talk about the politics and the organizations of religion itself. It isn't just a positive program about religion. Mm-hmm. It's looking at it from a number of aspects. And so as I was speaking to them, realizing that they were really defining the religious structures and the religious institutions negatively, but they had a free-flowing a free-flowing spirituality, more individualistic, a little more loose, I guess, in terms of rather than be told what to think or what to believe, they had their own connection.
Yeah, free thinking might be the best description for something like that. And of course, that's a more or less a prescription for atomization. There won't be, if enough people feel that way, there won't be any religious institutions. Everybody will just be believing his own thing or her own thing. That's an interesting trend in and of itself.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a real part of it. Now, Gary Lauderman would say, no, that's okay. He's saying that he wants to define that people are more religious than ever, even though they're not connected with the First Methodist or First Baptist or First Presbyterian Church. They go to the Church of Oprah,
right.
Or they go to the baseball game, or football, or vampires, or whatever it might be. Those kinds of he would say that there are various elements in our culture, in his book Sacred Matters, that are religious. That you would look at rituals, communities, beliefs, superstitions, you might say.
Right.
And in fact, even in the case of Oprah, you have a figure who gives you wise advice.
And she's benevolent and seemingly all-powerful.
It could be the cult of Stewart. It could be.
Well, I'd like to start that one. I've been trying to get my own kids to respect me more, but I can't get beyond them. No, one very interesting aspect of this is that the United States Supreme Court has never actually been able to, or maybe hasn't really attempted to define what religion means. So as far out as some of those things you've been mentioning sound, vampires and all the rest of it, the court has never actually come up with a workable definition of religion. And that's a very important omission, because the religion clauses talk about that. They say, you know, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or restricting the free exercise thereof, that is, of religion. If you can't even decide what religion is, then how do you apply those rules?
Right. You know, you think of, I just did a wedding for my own daughter in New York State.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter Katie married Amber. So I had to do it in New York. I couldn't do that in Tennessee.
Wait a second, John. This is sounding like a lesbian wedding.
It was. Yes,
and you officiated a lesbian wedding up in New York State, and you haven't been kicked out of your denomination yet?
Well, they haven't. Not yet.
Uh-huh.
We're not. Well, I don't know what all that will happen. But the point, what I was thinking was, is that I had to go through a big process
right. To
get okayed by the city of New York and ultimately the state of New York. I had to, you know, my license, my address, an official statement that I was in good standing with my denomination.
Really?
Which was kind of, and $15.
So you went up to New York and you performed the ceremony, and I hope I'm not bringing up a sore subject. I said it almost in passing, almost as a humorous thing, but do you think that the Presbyterian denomination will object to the fact that you have done this?
Well, I have coming up on my program an interview with Frank Schaefer, who is a Methodist minister,
mm-hmm.
who was just charged and found guilty for doing a wedding for his son six
yes.
years ago.
Yes, yes, I saw that.
And he could lose his ordination if he doesn't agree to not do it again. And so, but it's far more restrictive in the Methodist Church. That's probably, of the mainline churches, that's the one of the last ones to move to more
yeah.
acceptance. So my denomination is, it's a little nebulous whether actually it's wrong or not. There's no rule that says you can't.
And moreover, if I recall my religious history, the Presbyterian Church always prides itself on being self-governing at a local level, right? And
well,
so there's maybe less
yes.
hierarchical than other churches?
No, we still, you know, we can still take people to heresy court, I suppose, if we want to. It just isn't done very much.
Uh-huh.
And so that's, in fact, there have been, ministers who have been tried and found guilty for performing same-sex weddings.
Good heavens. Now, if they take you to heresy court, we've got to do an episode on that.
Yeah.
Can we do an episode on that?
We can certainly do it.
Okay.
I would say, you know, that would be very interesting.
I don't
there
mean to
three,
make...
There are 300 of us who already signed a document saying that we are going to do, that we're doing these weddings and we're
You're
doing
gonna
them publicly.
Do it.
And I would imagine this summer at the General Assembly when the Presbyterian Church meets that will be... An authoritative interpretation, as they call it, will be passed that will allow ministers to do that.
So you think you're going to be on the winning side of this one?
Yeah.
Well, I wish you luck in that. And I certainly don't mean to make light of it. I mean, I guess I was just a little taken aback when you took my question very seriously about being in trouble with your denomination. But that brings up another, let's bring it back to our subject today.
Sure.
That brings up another fact, is that many of these nuns
mm-hmm.
who are rising
mm-hmm.
are themselves clergy. I mean, quite honestly, you've always struck me as being one of the more unusual ministers I've known. But there are others like you out there, aren't there?
There are many of us, and some of us are more closeted than others in terms of what we believe. There's an organization called the Clergy Project. Again, Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, along with Linda LaScola, did a paper a few years ago called Clergy Who Are No Longer Believers.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked about clergy who have to kind of... be somewhat in secret of their real beliefs, but there are quite a few of them, and it's kind of interesting sociological development about that issue.
It certainly
and so,
is.
So in fact, this Clergy Project is kind of a self-help group, an online self-help group for clergy who are no longer can do it,
mm-hmm.
keep up the facade. In fact, of not believing and yet being forced to do.
Well,
the
what
beliefs.
Does a person do? I mean, I guess they've got a couple of choices. They can just resign. They can leave their churches, or they can be fired from their churches.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can go out and try to find a denomination like yours, or a congregation like yours that will actually support that perspective. Which brings us back to you, and I'm just fascinated by you, if you don't mind. Again, we're here in Northeast Tennessee. This is a very conservative, very red state, very deeply red state, maybe one of the reddest parts of this red state. And yet here you are in Elizabethan, Tennessee, with a thriving congregation that seems supportive of this perspective. And that to me is a remarkable thing.
Yeah, and that isn't me. That congregation was like that.
Take
why
a
I
little
came here.
Credit. Take a little credit. Okay.
Well, I'm
part
continuing along a trajectory that I think that my predecessor had. And Yeah, well, I mean, just to put it in crass business terms, there's a market.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I mean, in a very red state, there's still a few blue people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of our reason for this congregation to exist and to flourish. That there are people here all over the place who are also looking for an expression of faith that is broader than what they've brought up with. For example, I think that there are people who are religious but are non-theists.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They appreciate the community, they appreciate the ceremony, they appreciate the values, but they simply don't believe there's a divine being.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's a growing number. And I think that question comes up with a lot of people. What does that mean to be religious and be religious and then not believe in God? So there's all kinds of ways to be non-theist or atheist.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, John, this has been my experience as I've seen mainline churches. In fact, I've been to several mainline churches where there are six people left in an auditorium or sanctuary for, you know, built for 300. And then I've gone to other much more vibrant churches where they might technically be a member of this or that denomination, but you talk to anybody there and they say, oh, no, I'm a Baptist, or no, I'm nothing, or no, I'm this or I'm that. It's a much more ecumenical thing, and they're just really looking for community, and they're looking for a place to go and meet people and do some good, but no longer that interested in the particular doctrines of whatever religion they were brought up in. So it's been my own individual experience that what you're saying is really true, and that there are more and more of these people out there of all ages.
Right. You know, I think a great religion meets Saturdays at the farmer's market. I mean, a lot of my people who I know and a lot of friends I know in a lot of other contexts don't belong to church or anything like that, but they often search for their own kind of community in other places involved in whether it's an environmental projects or peacemaking projects or those kinds of things.
Well, do we have to fear then the fall of the Republic because of the rise of all these nuns? Does it just mean our whole society is going to splinter and fall apart?
No, I don't think so. I think it's exciting. I think a reaction that I would hope doesn't happen, and I sometimes see it, is really a closing of the wagons regarding religion, religious institutions, of not, you know, we talk about behaving badly, and I think it's self-inflicting wounds when churches go out of their way to try in a secular court to defend their right to do something, like... the rights not to against gay marriage, or their insistence that their way of praying needs to be in the public school, or that kind of idea that we're unless, you know, all Walmart employees say Merry Christmas, if they say Happy Holidays, we're being persecuted. I think that kind of self-serving behavior looks bad, and I think that serves further to drive people away from the institution.
Turning people off. And it obviously has constitutional implications. I mean, just to take one of your examples, if you talk about prayer in schools, you know, there's always been a question of which prayer. I mean, we've always had Protestants in this country. We've always had Catholics in this country. We've always had Jews in this country. We've also had people of other faiths or no faith at all. So, yeah, you want to have prayer in school, which prayer? And who gets to pick it? And I think that as our country becomes more religiously diverse, that question simply becomes more compelling. I mean, how could you ever have state-sponsored prayer when there are so many religions to choose from? As the nuns continue to rise, and as certainly the atheists continue to come out of the closet, I think we will see more and more and more of these controversies as people push back or test the boundaries of the establishment and free exercise clauses. So thanks very much for sharing your perspectives on this with us, John Schuck. We appreciate you, and we appreciate your program, Religion for Life. And when is it on?
It is on WETS on Thursdays at 8 and Sundays at 2.
Tremendous. And podcasts are available?
And podcasts, religionforlife.com.
Tremendous. Well, thanks very much, John. We appreciate you coming on.
All right. Thank you. It's been a joy.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've just finished talking to John Schuck, the host of Religion for Life and the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church in Elizabethton, Tennessee, all about the rise of the nuns. After the break, I'm going to speak to another minister, and this one is also a professor of political science. His name is Garrett Sheldon. Stay tuned. Thank you. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with a couple of different ministers today. I just finished talking to John Schuck, and now I'm going to talk to Garrett Sheldon all about the rise of the nuns, those people who don't claim any particular religious affiliation, though they might be spiritual, and what this means for American constitutional law.
I teach political science at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. I specialize in political theory and political theology. And I'm a Christian minister, an ordained Southern Baptist minister, and I live in Wise County, Virginia.
Well, Garrett, the only thing that's unbelievable about that is your accent. You do not sound like an ordained Southern Baptist minister.
Yes, well, actually, worldwide, many of them don't, but you recognize something, probably because you're from the Midwest. That I grew up in Wisconsin, and I still go back in the summers to Michigan, where they tell me I do have a Southern accent. So in Michigan, they do.
I see. It just depends on the ears of the listener. Well, at any rate, you seem uniquely qualified for our subject today because, of course, both of your ecclesiastical and your academic backgrounds. So as you know, the subject is the rise of the so-called nuns, the people who check off the box none of the above when they're asked what their religious persuasion is. I wonder if you could share with us any reaction you have to this phenomenon, either from a religious perspective or from a constitutional perspective. What do you think of all this?
Right. Well, of course, as a Christian, I'm saddened to hear that there's a rise of non-believers because I'm sorry they don't have the peace and the joy that comes from knowing Christ, the forgiveness of our sins and the eternal life in heaven, the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. I'm sorry that they don't have those things. So that's my first response to the rise in polls of or surveys of unbelievers. As St. Augustine said, God made us for himself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in him. So I know from the Bible that faith is a gift from God, and we don't know why some people have faith and others do not. I think one thing to look at now is the demographics of those who claim no religious belief. Demographically in the past, young people in their teens and 20s have often not had a religious faith, and they come to it later in life, in their 30s and 40s, usually when they have children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also a decline in religiosity can be due to social decline, disorder that we see around us all the time, economic problems, political cynicism. Of course, those social problems can also give a rise to religious belief and a seeking after God, as we see the increase with the current Pope. Pope Francis is having a tremendous effect on the increase of young people coming into the Catholic Church. So it really is, on some level, inexplicable. Naturally, as a Christian minister, I am concerned with the decline of faith and its effect on society. In terms of constitutional law, which Professor Harris, you know better than I do.
I don't know if I'm going to grant that point or not, Garrett. You're a pretty knowledgeable fellow, and you've written about this.
Well, we'll figure that out later. As you know, in the First Amendment, there's a religion clause, and really two clauses. The Establishment Clause, which is forbids a state church, and also has been interpreted against public support for religion. And then the Free Exercise Clause, which guarantees religious liberty or the free expression and practice of one's religion. In terms of the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, nuns, non-believers, my only concern in terms of constitutional law is that they or their leaders not use this as an excuse for suppressing religion, for limiting the expression and practice of those who do have faith, which I think is one of the great triumphs of the American constitutional system, where we could disagree in a civil and peaceful way with people of other faiths and avoid those horrible religious wars that we came out of in Europe. And the main reason for religious freedom, besides the founders' belief that that's the best way to evangelize, is to avoid these terrible unchristian acts of war in the name of religion. So I do hope that the rise of non-believers doesn't lead to an attempt to restrict the freedom and beliefs of others.
Have you seen any evidence of that, of any of these people trying to restrict religious freedom?
Not descending to public culture, but here just to, a couple of weeks ago, the whole controversy over the Duck Dynasty issue, I think, is the most recent. Of course, there are more constitutional cases where attempts are made to limit prayer in public or building churches in certain neighborhoods, a kind of, misinterpretation of religious freedom as freedom from religion, to restrict religious belief and expression. Whereas what the founders, Jefferson and Madison and so on, believed was a sort of lively and civilized exchange of religious views in a peaceful environment. Jefferson said famously about Charlottesville, when he was there in the early 1800s, he said, "Charlottesville, now that's, where our branch campus is, the University of Virginia, right?"
Yes, exactly. The branch campus of the University of Virginia. Wise, right.
He said, "Charlottesville has four churches, but very little conflict." I paraphrase. And in fact, at that time, Charlottesville was a very small village and had no church buildings. They had no church houses. And Jefferson said they all took turns, I think it was Episcopal, Methodist, Baptist, and Presbyterian, took turns using the public courthouse on Sundays for their worship services, and everyone would attend and hear each other's preachers. So it was that kind of spirit of freedom and ecumenicism that I think the founders had in mind, not prohibiting religious expression.
Well, you mentioned the Duck Dynasty controversy, and of course that's something that's been very much in the news, and we may very well do an episode on that in the not-too-distant future. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there was any suggestion that the government was trying to suppress or censor what Phil Robertson said. What it was a dispute between private parties. I mean, he made his statements in a magazine interview. The A&E network suspended him and then eventually reinstated him. And there was a robust public discussion of what he said and whether it was appropriate or inappropriate or whether it was an appropriate religious expression or whether it was prejudice or bigotry. But I'm not aware of any government intervention there. So is that really a legitimate suppression of religious freedom?
Well, of course, as you know, the line between public and private and culture and society is very thin. And while there wasn't an actual law suppressing Phil Robertson's religious beliefs or expressions, the idea that a public, really a public entity, I think they would be licensed by the FCC, wouldn't they, the A&E network?
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm not sure. I think they're a cable network, so I'm not certain exactly how they're regulated. You've unearthed some of my ignorance.
Well, I'm simply trying to say that it's public, and so whether we call it the culture wars or an actual government act, the point is that I would hope that those who don't share someone else's religious beliefs wouldn't try to suppress it either by law or punitively by firing them for expressing their religious beliefs. I found it fascinating as an example of American political culture. And there was some very good analysis on the left and the right of what this symbolized in our current state of American religion and politics.
It's striking to me that whereas throughout most of our history we had a very solid Protestant majority, at least nominally Protestant majority in this country, and most of the founders and throughout most of our history, now we find ourselves in a circumstance where not only are up to 20% of the population not ascribing to any particular religion, but if you look at some of our major institutions, you find that not only is there no longer a Protestant majority, sometimes there are no Protestants at all. And I'm thinking primarily of the current Supreme Court. I think currently we have 5 Catholics and 4 Jews. And I just find that striking.
Yes, it is. When you consider that for almost 400 years, this was the most Protestant, reformed Christian country in history. Now, I wouldn't make as sharp a distinction between Protestant and Catholic. I would say more the distinction between Christian and non-Christian. But my reading of the Duck Dynasty controversy and its conclusion was really that overall prevailing Christian ethos is still the vast majority. That's why the A&E decision was reversed, and even people in the media said they wish it had been handled differently. It reminds me of the book I'm sure you know so well, Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, written in the 1830s when this Frenchman toured America and wrote this wonderful, but we still think the best, analysis of the culture of America, Democracy in America. And he said the United States had a kind of, I don't mean this in a negative way, but a sort of generic Christianity. And that ethos, that culture of morality and basic, reverence for the Bible and the church and so on, I think still continues, even though it's changed a lot, and certainly the non-Christian values and preferences have increased. But I, for example, not just the young people's response, say, in Latin America to Pope Francis and the pouring into the Catholic Church of millions of young people, but I see it in college students, an increase in faith, an increase in seeking God, partly because we have strayed in the past 60 years.
Well, what a coincidence. Garrett Sheldon has just mentioned the upsurge in interest in spirituality in college students that he teaches. And so I thought maybe it's a good time now to speak to a college student I happen to know well. His name is Ben Harris, and he's a second year at the University of Virginia. What's been your experience, Ben, in Charlottesville with the students and the society there and the role of religion in it?
Well, UVA is conservative compared to other universities, but mm-hmm. liberal compared with the public at large, as pretty much all universities are.
Okay.
And religion is seldom brought up, mm-hmm. I feel, in general conversations. At UVA, there are tons of student religious organizations. A lot of people go to church there. But in general, Sunday is seen as a day to do homework and a day of recovery from hangovers, and less a day for going to church.
Mm-hmm. And what about in the classroom? Are the faculty, is there any reference made to religion? Or?
Well, if so, it's in an academic context. Mm-hmm. You'll study the effects of religion. But it's not used so much anymore as kind of a cultural benchmark. Mm-hmm. Just because it's university is indicative of larger trends in America. We're becoming more cosmopolitan and international. Mm-hmm. And you have kids from so many different backgrounds that it seems kind of silly to reference the Bible as a common source for everybody, because a lot of people have not read it. And it's just not, there's no prior knowledge assumed anymore.
Well, that is very interesting. That is somewhat of a contrast. I was about to say that your description is really not that unfamiliar to me. I was in college 30 years before you. And
you are old. That is true.
I am old. There's no question about that. Increasingly so every day. But, I mean, college even then, unless you were at a religious institution, was a fairly secular experience. There were no required chapel then. The professors tended to be non-religious, or at least didn't profess religion. But I do recall, on one occasion, I was actually in a German class, of all places, and we were writing essays. And I was marked down because I'd sort of missed the point of an essay assignment. And it turned out that the point was only discernible if one knew a certain biblical story that I happened not to have read or been exposed to. And when I protested to the professor, he looked at me and said, every educated person should have read that story in the Bible. And what I'm getting from you now is that that assumption, at least you've not encountered it at the University of Virginia.
I have not personally encountered it, and I'm sure there are some literature classes where biblical knowledge is encouraged prior to the class.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for the most part that if you need to understand something about a Bible, about the Bible for a lesson, it'll be explained in class.
Very.
It won't be something that, you know, it's assumed that everyone knows it.
Hmm. So the Bible, or at least sort of Western Christian tradition, no longer seems to have quite as central a place in academia. There's not quite an assumption that everyone has the same basic background as perhaps there was when I was in school 30 years ago, at least just based on our own individual experiences. I realize we're not taking a survey now. One other thing you've mentioned to me over time that I don't think I recall from my college days was the open declaration by many people that they are either agnostics or even atheists. That was anathema back in my day. People didn't, even if they felt that way, they didn't want to admit it.
There's little to no stigma now about being openly atheist or agnostic. Mm-hmm. There's even a club, or CIOs as we call them at UVA.
Mm-hmm. CIOs?
Acronym, I don't even know what it stands for.
Some sort of college club. Okay, all right.
But the Virginia Atheists and Agnostics, mm-hmm. I know a few people in there. They're very nice people. And they'll do fun fundraising drives. Like they recently had, you know, they had buckets for each denomination. You could donate for your particular denomination. If you reached a certain threshold, they would send an atheist, one of their members, to church for that particular denomination. So they had different religions competing to save their souls.
So atheists raised funds by offering an opportunity to various religious denominations to come and save one of the atheists from the hellfire.
More or less.
Well, I find that amusing in the first instance, but what I find also, again, is just the openness of this. So there really is no stigma attached to saying I'm an atheist or I'm an agnostic.
I don't think I've ever seen it. And in addition, there's just, you know, even for people who identify very strongly with a particular religion, it's not necessarily Christianity anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's student organizations for every major religion and mm-hmm. most of the minor ones too. I remember I was walking on the lawn and a couple students offered me a free cupcake in celebration of a Hindu religious day. You know, I am not particularly a member of the Hindu faith, but I accepted that cupcake. I felt strong religious reasons to do so at the moment.
Well, Ben Harris, a second year at the University of Virginia, thanks for sharing with us your experiences.
Yeah, I'm kind of hungry. Can I go home now?
And that's our show. Thanks so much to John Shuck, the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Elizabethton, Tennessee, and the host of the public radio show Religion for Life, which is produced at WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee. Thanks also to Garrett Sheldon, who is a Baptist pastor and also a member of the faculty of the University of Virginia's College at Wise. And finally, thanks to my son, Ben Harris, who's a second-year student at the University of Virginia, for giving us the perspective of the younger generation on the rise of the nuns. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. My name is Stuart Harris. And hey, our theme song is done by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Isn't it cool? Remember, you are part of the American experiment.